the people who listen will also get it. Basically, if you look at the description of when the next course starts, I believe it says April 11th, and then there's no session on April 18th. But I'm going to be traveling on the 11th, and I had thought that I could make it work to do it on the 11th, but now that my schedule is more clear, I realize that I can't do a class on the 18th, on the 11th. So what we'll do instead is just start on the 18th. So there won't be any class on the 11th, and I can make it work on the 18th. So I wanted to make sure everybody can understand. Everybody, I want to make sure, I'm sorry, I was reading the chat messages, a distraction right in the middle of everything. So I just want to make sure that that's clear to everybody, that the next session will start not on April 11th, but on April 18th, and then otherwise it'll just continue the same way. Any questions about that? Pretty straightforward.
I will also send out an email to remind everybody.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. So.
Dean, I'm going to call you. Somebody has their speakers on. I'm sorry, Dad.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny, not much of an echo, but a little bit of an echo. We'll see. Okay. I wanted to start today with a Zen story. I just happened to read this yesterday, I guess it was. And I thought it fit in very nicely to what we're talking about. So the story involves a Zen teacher named Pai Chang, and all I know about him is that he was very famous. But this is a story from when he was the student and he was with his master. And he and his master were walking in the countryside, and some geese flew by overhead. And later, as they were still walking, his master asked him, where are the geese? And Pai Chang answered, they've flown away. And his master hit him and said, how could they have flown away? So, that's the story. I guess I will give people a chance to react to it. Anybody see a connection to what we've been talking about? No, and in fact, I'm leaving, said someone. Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and tell you the connection that I see. And it's based partly on the fact that I was reading this in a book by a Western author, and he helps make the point. And I'm not sure that it's the same point that the story has in the Zen tradition, but it's a point that I think fits well for us. But he said the problem with Pai Chang's answer when he said the geese have flown away is that it was a self-centered answer. And the word that is troubling there is the word away, right? So Pai Chang's master says, how could the geese ever have flown away? And the reason he says that is because the geese don't fly away from themselves, right? They only fly away from Pai Chang. So when, okay, we're still having a couple of problems with our telephone call. I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm just going to charge bravely ahead.
I think that's Vivian.
Okay, let's see. I'm going to give you a chance to tune out that static, because I'm sure it's hard for other people. Okay. Okay. So now you've had a chance to think a little more about the significance of that story.
Sorry. Me and I muted you because I you want to ask a question, please use the chat.
Okay. So let me come back to the point of that story then, as far as it relates to us. When Pai Chang says, the geese have flown away, he's really saying the geese have flown away from me. And that is a wonderful example of a kind of, the kind of story that the self always tells. You know, the self essentially is always saying, this is the way it is for me. And, even when you say, I see a wall in front of me, you may just say, I see a wall, but you're always saying, I see the wall for me. Now, that's not so bad, if you understand that that's what you're doing. But most of the time, we don't understand that. Most of the time, we think that that's reality. We just automatically believe that the way reality operates, the way reality functions, is as in terms of a story that puts me at the center. That's the purpose of that little Zen story. There is something else that story made me think about, though, and I think it's important for the underlying approach that we've been taking in TSK. And that is that the story, the way I've just described it, it depends an awful lot on language. If Pai Chang hadn't said the geese have flown away, but it just said, let's look at some examples. If Pai Chang had said, instead of saying the geese have flown away, he had said the geese have gone, that would be an even more obvious example of a story that centers on the self. Because, from the geese's point of view, they haven't gone anywhere. It's only from the point of view of the self that you would say the geese have gone. But suppose he had just said, I don't see the geese anymore. That would have been a kind of you could say it was self-centered, but it would have been a clear acknowledgement. It wouldn't have been making any claim about the nature of reality. It just would have been saying, my experience is that I don't see the geese anymore. And I think it's clear, what the difference is among all of those, but there is a kind of a response that where you say, well, gee, that's all just a question of language. It's kind of accidental that he said it one way or the other way. And I think the answer to that is that it does make a difference how you speak if you let the language be a pointer towards how you're understanding, toward your view, toward your sense of what's real. So this was a great example. I mean, why did Pai Chang's teacher hit him? I suppose you could say it was to help make the point, It was like, don't you see, dummy, don't you see that by giving that answer, you're interpreting reality in terms of the self? And the language is just a clue to that. The language is just a pointer. And if you had used different language, then maybe that clue wouldn't have been there. But the underlying structure, the underlying understanding of what's real would have been there. And that's really what we care about. And I think the reason that that's important is that, it's a question that comes up with TSK sometimes. People say, well, so many words, so much is being said, and does it really matter what we say? And the answer is, it doesn't matter what you say, except that what you say reveals your understanding. It reveals the way that you make sense out of the world. And ultimately, it reveals the way that we do, in fact, make sense out of the world, the way that we're always telling stories and then inhabiting those stories, as we've discussed. And that's really a key point in TSK, I think. I mean, you keep Rinpoche keeps presenting things from different perspectives and doing different kinds of analysis and working out the logic of certain positions. And the whole point of that, you could say, is to get you beyond the verbal insight, but it's using language in that specific way. Anybody want to say anything about that?
Lois had a question on the chat.
Oh, yeah, okay. Do you mean outside in the world or out of the world? I don't understand that question, Lois. You have to rephrase it. So I will let you rephrase it. Anybody else? No? Okay. Then we'll move on. Well, as I did in the, and I'll come back to your question when you've rephrased it, Lois. As I did in the orientation, I want to start with the second part of the reading, the part that comes from chapter 27, because I think that in a way you could say chapter 25 is continuing. Oh, okay, Lois is just asking a terminological question. Acting out in the world or out of this world? Well, I'm sorry, I don't remember what I said. What we care about is not the words we use to describe what we're experiencing, because we could always use a different description. What we care about is the words as a clue to the way that we are, I guess.
Maximale Länge erreicht. Nachricht gesendet. Vielen Dank für Ihren Anruf. Auf Wiederhören.
Okay, somebody spoke German in my ear, I think.
Somebody spoke German into your ear. Yeah, they said right. Where did the German go? The message just said it sounds like they had a voicemail on, and they said you've reached the maximum length of time for your voicemail. Thanks a lot for calling. That's what it said. Okay. I don't think that advances us very much. So anyway, I guess I've driven that point into the ground or beyond, so we'll move on. At the beginning of chapter 27, Rinpoche says something that's actually really, really amazing, I think, and worth reflecting on. You know, he says, sometimes it happens, I'm looking at the first paragraph, I'm not exactly quoting it, but he says, sometimes it happens that we lose that focus on the self, the one that we were just talking about. And when we do, the result is likely to be a profound fear. Now I am quoting, an existential anxiety that can paralyze the will and destroy all hope for joy. Okay, let's assume that that's the case. Maybe you've had that experience, maybe you haven't. But then the next thing he says is, we forget about it. And in effect, we make ourselves forget about it. And that raises a really interesting question to me. It's a little like, there's a hypothetical I've heard people use sometimes. They say, suppose someone said to you, I will pay you $100,000, and in exchange, I will perform an operation on you with no anesthetic. And it'll be very, very painful, but I guarantee you, we'll give you some anesthetic afterwards, and I guarantee you that you won't remember any of it. I guarantee you it'll be gone. So for 5 minutes, it's going to be very, very painful. I'll pay you $100,000, and then you won't even know that it ever happened. And so the hypothetical is, you know, would you do that? Well, the similarity between that example and what Rinpoche says here is the notion, you know, if you've had a moment of profound existential anxiety and then it disappears, you push it out of your awareness, does it even count? You know, is it real? In what sense is it real? Well, you could say, you know, it's a little bit like the geese, I guess. You could say, the moment has gone. But from the point of view of the self after the moment, when you pushed it away, you say, well, it never happened because I don't remember it. So it kind of goes to the relationship of memory to existence. But what's interesting here is you know, it's kind of asking us to take something on faith. That's not quite the right way to say it. But it's saying, maybe we don't know, we don't, maybe we say, no, I've never had a moment of existential anxiety like that. I've never had a sense that the world does not focus on me. I mean, we'll talk about other ways that might come up in a moment. But you might say, you know, I've never had that. And then the answer, somebody could say, well, you probably have, you just don't remember. Why don't you remember? Because it was too scary. You forced yourself not to remember. So, you know, maybe I'm giving too many analogies, but it's something like the whole controversy that was very big in the 1990s in the field of therapy, where people started reporting all of these instances of childhood abuse. And what they said was, with the initial argument was, these had been suppressed, which is a very standard move in a lot of kinds of therapy, or repressed, I guess. And people didn't remember them, but then through therapy, the memories came back. Right? So the argument there was, you know, the fact that the memory was repressed doesn't mean that it didn't happen. But you don't know that it happened until in some way you bring it out. So here, it's really the same point being made. We have these moments, maybe, where he says in moments of surprise or unusual intensity, we have these moments and then we push them away and we just forget about them. Lois, I see you're asking about moments being invented, but I'm sorry, we still aren't quite connecting. I just don't remember saying that. So I think we better drop it. The difficulty, or the question is, does it make any sense to talk about these moments of existential anxiety or moments where the sense of self drops away if in fact we don't have any experience of them? Or is that just something we say, well, maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't? Well, there is a reason to consider the possibility, and there's actually several reasons. One is the fact that we react with this kind of anxiety. Let's assume for the moment that that happens. It's not because the moment itself is so frightening or scary. It's because the self is frightened by the experience. And so if Rinpoche is right, if in fact we do have moments where the self drops away, that possibility is in fact really positive. And it's good to hold open, you know, it's good to consider that that might be the way things are. Even if we don't have any memory like that. And in fact, it's a little like saying, you know, I mean, let's call those moments of real openness, by openness, I mean moments where the identity of the self is not really controlling everything and the story of the self is not really controlling everything. Let's say those are moments of profound insight, right? But then the self reacts and we bury them. We refuse to acknowledge them. Well, if that's the case, then it would be wonderful if we could find a way to be able to acknowledge it without triggering, without activating that great fear on the part of the self. Now, the other reason, I said there are a couple of reasons why it's important to consider this. A second reason, and actually I think there's a third, but the second reason is that although Rinpoche doesn't say it right here, he kind of suggests later, and I'm sure some of you have been thinking this, that if you have these moments where the self is not so central to your experience, that might be a very positive experience. You know, Rinpoche describes it in terms of this tremendous anxiety on the part of the self, but it might be a very positive experience, and the way you can see that is that description is very consistent with all sorts of positive experiences that we have. You know, if we're doing something, let's say we're in the middle of some activity that we really enjoy. Maybe it's physical activity, or maybe we're seeing something very beautiful, listening to beautiful music, out for a walk in nature, those kinds of things. And we don't, in those moments, let's say, he says moments of unusual intensity. In those moments, maybe later we would say, I didn't have a very strong sense of self, or my usual sense of self just didn't seem to be operating in the same way. But those are very positive moments. Those are not moments of existential anxiety. And the interesting question is are they really the same thing? Are those two possible reactions? And there is an answer to that, which I think in itself is an interesting point that Rinpoche makes in the chapter, but he doesn't do it right here. He does it on, you could look at page 225 at the bottom. So a couple of pages later, he says, he's discussed these three possible responses, and we're going to go back to the other two in a moment. In the last paragraph that starts on the bottom of page 225, he says, fear is one response by the self, lack of interest is one response by the self, confusion is one response by the self. And he says, in addition to all those, the self may respond to the challenge of not knowing by moving to appropriate it, by turning it into a position. And then the example he gives is a very is an example of a really positive, really powerful position, where he has the self saying, yes, I understand. I've held on to my positions and my stories, but now I see the truth. You know, now I see that I don't have to be bound by my stories. What beauty, what joy, what openness. At last I've found my true home. So it sounds great. it sounds like, why do we study TSK, right? It's so that we can say, among other things, we can say, now I see that I don't have to be bound by my positions and my stories. Now I see the truth, and it's beautiful, and it's joyful. All that sounds good. The point that Rinpoche is making is that when we do that, we are just immediately setting up a new story. And it's very much the same thing. There's a moment where the self really is not central, where the story, the founding story of the self, is not operating, or at least if it's operating, it's not where we're putting all of our attention. We're not investing ourselves in making sure and guaranteeing that the story of the self is preserved above everything else. And then there's two possible responses, he says. One is that we just push it away so fast that it's as though it never happened. And the other is that we welcome it and turn it into a story. I don't think Rinpoche wants for that to be discouraging. It's not as though those are the only two possibilities, but you could say those are the two likeliest possibilities. And that's why we really have to make a lot of effort, you know. That's why we do a program like this, is because we want to be able to open up other possibilities besides turning it into total panic or a holding on to a positive experience. I think I'm not going to bother to go in that direction. That's the point. There's those two alternatives. One of them is much more attractive than the other, obviously, but they both lead to lead us right back to the story. There was a moment of openness, and then suddenly we're right back in the story. Now I want to also go through the third possibility that Rinpoche discusses here, because in terms of our ordinary everyday experience, it seems to me this is the one that's the most interesting to explore. He says that the self doesn't necessarily have this moment of total panic, total anxiety. And by the way, if you want a description of that moment, of that way of being, I think there's a description that at least comes close. It's different in some ways, and I haven't read it in years, but it's in Jean-Paul Sartre's novel, Nausea, Le Nausée in French, for those of you who read French. And I don't know what it is in German. Anyway, he has a moment where things suddenly take over, you could say. And he has a sense of there being no self, just things. And it evokes in him this quality of nausea, which is what the whole novel is about, in a sense. That's the existential anxiety. That's the profound fear. That's that reaction. And then we have this other reaction that we've talked about. But most of the time, I think, what happens is more like what Rinpoche describes in the rest of the reading from chapter 27. We respond in an emotional way. And he discusses two or three different forms of emotion. One is a kind of dismissal, right? I'm looking at page 224 now. The self has a certain kind of experience, and it doesn't really acknowledge that experience, but certain kinds of thoughts start to come up, like, oh, this is boring, this isn't interesting, this isn't important, this isn't something that I know how to think about. Other people ought to be thinking, you know, other people may think about this. This all comes up, you could say, in the context, in kind of the context of TSK inquiry, but it may also come up in the context of a kind of spontaneous experience that we have, in which the self, you know, the sense of self is challenged. You just say, oh, time to move on, time to do something else. You know, think I'll have a snack, think I'll go see a movie, think I'll call up my friend or read the news. You turn away. And that's, you could say it's a specific example of what Rinpoche said before, of pushing away the real experience we have of experience without the story of the self. The reason I think it's a little different, and the reason I think it's more characteristic and really good to become, to kind of tune into, is that it has this particular emotional flavor of being bored, being too busy, being restless, being impatient. That flavor, when you see that flavor operating, I don't want to say this is true in every case, but when you see that flavor operating, it may well be a sign that there's a kind of a knowledge in operation, excuse me, or a kind of an experience going on that is not the kind of experience that the self is ready to accept. And the clue to it is the emotional tone, like the tone of boredom, for example. But I gave a talk the other day to a high school class. They were 14-year-olds. That's kind of interesting. And at one point, one of them asked me, we were talking about Buddhism and meditation, and one of them asked me, do you ever get bored when you're meditating? And I thought about that, and I gave an answer. But then later I was thinking, there's this whole range of different possibilities that are closely related to each other, but they're different. There's getting bored, there's getting distracted, and there's getting restless, right? And those are similar, quite similar to each other, but they're all examples that signal a kind of an underlying emotion going on, right? And that emotion, again, points back to the possibility, at least, that we have seen something, that for a moment, at least, we have known something that we would rather not know. And so we kind of put out this emotion. It's a little bit like, you know, if you walk into a room and there's some terrible smell in the room, and so you quickly go get a can of air freshener and spray it, you know, so that you're overlaying that terrible smell. Well, the terrible smell might be, based on what Rinpoche is saying here, you know, the smell of truth. You know, our reaction that calls it terrible, well, that's our reaction. So boredom, distraction, preoccupation, as he says here, a kind of a restless dismissal, why would anybody want to look at this? You know, some of you may have had those reactions sometimes, either in reading TSK or in you know, very different situations. So you know, maybe, I don't know, I'm going to get very psychological now, which isn't so helpful, but suppose you're at a meeting, a business meeting, and you're feeling really restless and bored. And you know, if somebody asked you why later, you'd say, well, it's because they were talking about such boring things. Right? They were, you know, what they had to say wasn't interesting. But maybe what's going on is that boredom is a kind of an emotional response that covers over a kind of knowing. And you know, maybe what you know is that, oh, I don't know. I won't go on with that example anymore. Let's just say maybe it covers over a kind of knowing. The other possibility that Rinpoche discusses in this connection is confusion. And that's another great example of something I think we're all familiar with, and it's not some big existential crisis, and it's not some wonderful experience of the oneness of all things, which kind of the two extremes. It's just feeling confused. And what Rinpoche says about that is very clear, and I think this is a wonderful passage in Love of Knowledge, partly because we really do all know something about confusion. He says that kind of confusion is the self's version of the deep not knowing that challenges existence. So why would we want to challenge existence? Well, because existence, in the way that, or in the context that we've been discussing, existence is the result of a story. Right? Existence is when you say, this is the way things are. And it's not that the story is necessarily wrong, or a better word is true, is false. It's not that the story is necessarily false. In the same way that you would say, if you read a novel, the question to ask about the story, about the novel, is not whether the novel is false. I mean, by nature, by definition, it's false. It's about things that never happened. But that's not the important point about the novel. Or if you talk about the truth of a novel, I suppose you're talking at a different level, not in terms of existence. And confusion comes in when there's an underlying knowing, you could say, which is a not knowing. So maybe I shouldn't say it that way, because that doesn't have to be confusing in quite that way. The point is that we have an understanding of how things are. We have a story, or multiple stories that build on each other, starting with the founding story of the self. And then there is this possibility that comes up of not knowing that story. And what I really mean by that is not knowing that the story is not knowing that the story is true. The story is there, but we no longer know that that's the truth. And that not knowing has a tremendous potential value to it. It's a kind of an unknowing, as he said, right? Maybe look at the last sentence in the last paragraph on page 224. He's talking about this confusion, and he says it has its genesis in the specific knowledge that a story has in some way failed to cohere and has thus become unknown. So we unknow the story, but then the response to that is confusion. And I think that's really would be worth exploring on so many different levels. So often, just on a very simple level, you could say when the self is, or let's talk about, children learning something. So they're learning something, even, like algebra. And they get confused. They say, I don't understand. And you can see, I think, sometimes with children, or it doesn't have to be children, how they reach a decision, they reach the conclusion that they don't understand something, and then they turn off to it. Did I lose my...
We lost you.
Yeah, I lost my... I don't know why. And I see there isn't anything I can do about it. Okay, well, you have my voice. You'll have to go with that. I was looking at Arthur's question. I'll say something about that in a moment. So it's this unknowing is actually a gateway into knowing. It's a very, very important point in TSK, I think. So I was saying that people pile on confusion when their founding story in some way is being challenged. And it really is sad, that you wind up, you choose in favor of confusion instead of choosing in favor of knowing, and it's because you're willing to make that sacrifice in order to keep the story going. You would rather know things to be the way they are, even if the way they are is very dissatisfying and leaves you feeling, hungry for something and you don't know what it is. You would rather do that. And that's something that gets talked about in chapter 25, which I'm glad about because I was feeling bad that we weren't going to get to talk about chapter 25. So now I've at least referenced what Rinpoche says. It talks about making a bargain with yourself. I'm willing to be confused. I'm willing to be frustrated. I'm willing to be dissatisfied as long as I get to have myself, as long as I get to have my story. And confusion is a way for the self to perpetuate its story in the face of a not knowing that the story is true. And let me just say one more thing about that, and then I'll mention something about the questions that have come up. And that is that if you look back at a lot of the analysis that takes place in Love of Knowledge, it's kind of a fairly rigorous analysis saying, well, time can't be what we think it is, the identity of the self can't be what we think it is. Again and again and again, what Rinpoche is doing is trying to activate that not knowing so that you can't just settle for the ordinary knowledge. If somebody brings up a question and you say, well, everybody knows, the answer is this. Rinpoche is trying to create a condition or a situation where you find yourself unknowing what you ordinarily know. But of course, in light of this analysis, the response to that is often going to be a kind of a confusion or a restlessness or an asking, why is this important? Why should we care? All of those reactions are possibilities, and it's because something very fundamental is being challenged. So this whole notion of not knowing, of asking the right kind of question, that's something that we're going to explore a lot more in the next session. Now let me go back and look here. Arthur is asking the question, if I put away the emotion, I can better observe my lack of intensity. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by lack of intensity there, but yes, the idea here is to what could happen if we didn't get caught up in the emotional response, because the emotional response, even in the form of these fairly subtle emotions like not knowing, like boredom or restlessness or confusion, those are the way that the self covers up knowledge, and it means that you lose the ability to observe. So to that extent, yes, I think that's right. Lois is asking, or it makes a point. I mean, I think you can all, well, maybe you can't all see the chat, so I will just quote her. She says, sometimes when she's writing a poem, she says, I have an experience that I can't put words to, and I wrestle and wrestle and then leave it. And she says, now thinking what you're saying, I think there's a lot more to it. I can go into that. And that's right. I think, you know, that not knowing, it doesn't mean that you fall into a kind of a blankness or a dullness. It means that you unknow what you ordinarily know. And I think that in general, art, poetry, music, graphic arts are about ways of unknowing what you ordinarily know. Now, they may happen within the context of the founding story. They may not take us as far as TSK would like us to go, but they're definitely pointing in that direction. And Tina says, so would it be better to relax into the unknowing? And yeah, I think that is exactly where this is heading. To be comfortable with not knowing. And that operates at many, many different levels. You know, sometimes the place that I've been looking at it a lot, really over the last couple of years at least, is being willing not to know, well, two things. Not to know what to do next, to be willing to allow that to stay open, because you will do something. And the other way it comes up is being willing not to know whether I'm doing the right thing. You know, I notice myself doing something, and the question comes up, is this right? Or, you know, am I just fooling myself in some way? And you can be willing not to know, but you have to have touched that quality of not knowing, which is different from confusion. It's really, really, really different from confusion. It's an openness, not a fog. I'm just going to use those two images. Okay, well, I think that's a place to stop, and this is the end of the program. Maybe some of you won't go on, but there's certainly a lot that we've covered, I'm sure you'll have a lot to work with on your own, and I hope also that we've been able to see the ways that you can work with the reading, with love of knowledge, and with the exercises. And for those of you who are going on, I think the readings have been posted on the website now, and as I've mentioned, we're going to continue moving ahead in the book for a few weeks when we start again on April 18th. And then we're going to go to the first part of the book, which is kind of an experiment on my part. But I think if we approach some of the material in the first part of the book, where Rinpoche really is talking about the power of inquiry, which is an inquiry that is willing to face the not knowing, then we'll have a lot of interesting things to explore. So,
we meet on the 11th or on the 18th?
No, that was something I mentioned right at the beginning of the talk, and Kathleen will send out an email about it also. I realized that I couldn't do it on the 11th because I'll be traveling just when the class is supposed to happen. Our first meeting is on the 18th, and then we'll go ahead from then. We were going to